we realized that this tryptophan metabolism in the microbiome and in the host is altered in IBD, but also in alcoholic liver disease, in celiac disease, in rheumatoid arthritis, and in many others. So clearly it seems that tryptophan metabolism in the microbiome is one of its major functions. A little bit like, you know, production of short-chain fatty acid or metabolism of bile acids.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And our guest today on the podcast, I'm really thrilled, is Harry Sockel. And Harry is at the University of Sorbonne, and he's a gastroenterologist who's done work on so many fascinating areas. I can't wait to dive into some of the different areas that you work on, Harry. Can you maybe start by telling us how you ended up working in the general field of the microbiome and commensal organisms?
Sure. First, hello, and thank you very much for having me today. So actually, I've been interested in the microbiome since my residency in gastroenterology. Actually, I met someone I consider a kind of pioneer in the field, Philippe Marteau, so who was a professor of gastroenterology at this time, and it's really him who basically brought me into this field. He then connected me to Joël Doré. I did a master's degree with Joël Doré, and this is where how everything started for me.
Now, Philippe and Joël, of course, are giants in the field, both of them, and tremendous influences. Do you think, as a gastroenterologist now, has the microbiome become central to kind of how gastroenterologists think, or are you still a bit of an outlier? I mean, we normally only meet gastroenterologists who are interested in the microbiome, so I have no sense of whether it's generally accepted by gastroenterologists to be an important field.
So now, for many years, the microbiome was seen by gastroenterologists and globally by physicians as something interesting to study, but not with, you know, true direct application in medicine. I think the field moved now, and more physicians understand and believe that the microbiome is involved in many diseases and is a target for diagnosis, prognosis, and also treatment.
Harry, I'm interested in how earlier in your career you seem to be prudent in pursuing the global description strategy instead of the candidate microorganism strategy. And that happened around the same time that our ability to pursue the global description strategy seemed to take off with lots of advances. I wonder, just did you have hunches that you were going to find out things about commensals as opposed to the usual suspects, the pathogenics, or were you just treating it as a scientist that just wanted to get a better handle on what was going on?
Yeah, so actually, I was lucky enough to start my research in the microbiome field when, you know, all this molecular biology field exploded. So we started by analyzing, just describing the microbiome of patients with IBD using, you know, TTGE, using flow cytometry, fluorescent in situ hybridization. So the first, you know, methods that were available, and then real-time PCR and so on. And I think, like for many fields in science, without this technological progress, we would not be there today. Honestly, I didn't have any hunch. Of course, I read all the literature at this time that was available, you know, early in 2000. Which was not so much, but I didn't have any hunch. And actually, it's really my research since the beginning and until now is driven by the results.
And Harry, I mean, I think it's fair that many fields, you know, the advance in technology can almost hijack a field, and it becomes transfixed, and just by the technology itself. And just because you can sequence something, you do, because why wouldn't you? But then eventually a field matures and comes back towards the biology and the clinical relevance. Are we at a point yet in gastroenterology where microbiome informs any decisions you make clinically or influences any decisions you make clinically?
So the answer is no. We are not there yet. I completely agree with you. Now generating data, sequencing, even massively sequencing is easier and cheaper and cheaper. And so now I think most of the work is to come back to the biology. And I think there is, from my point of view, too much effort on the sequencing, which is already, we already have tons of data, and clearly not enough on the biology, on the experimental work, which is much more laborious, much more, much slower. But without that, we cannot do anything. So currently in gastroenterology, we are not using any microbiome data to guide our treatment or decision. Hopefully it will be the case in the next few years, because I think that now the field is mature enough to design, true biomarker that will guide a true medical decision. I think also that the field is more and more ready for microbiome-based therapeutic intervention. We have many studies for fecal microbiota transplantation. We are using FMT on a daily basis on my center for, of course, recurrent C. diff infection. There are many clinical trials in IBD and other gastroenterology disease suggesting an effect of this type of treatment. Of course, applying FMT to, chronic and very frequent disease might be a huge challenge. And actually, I even do not think it will be feasible to apply this type of treatment to, for example, patients with IBD in general, because it's too much frequent and chronic disease. But then the field is moving, as you know, to more defined product based on the microbiome. So thanks to all this analysis and also to FMT studies, there are many candidate microorganisms which may have therapeutic effect. And these microorganisms are, of course, currently investigating in clinical trials.
That's what I find very interesting about your work, is you did incredible work pursuing the global description strategy. And then you found that F. prosnitsky was depleted, and you've also been a champion of FMT, which is a more global approach, but you now are seeing a lot of advantages to the live biological products. Can you talk about where you see the field going in terms of taking care of your patients, developing therapeutic interventions?
Sure. So I think FMT is really an incredible treatment for recurrent C. diff infection. And honestly, as a physician, it's probably one of the most rewarding experience, because you see patients that are in pain for weeks and months. And honestly, in 24 to 48 hours, the patient is cured. And this is really like magic. However, besides this type of indication, despite this type of acute and not so frequent indication, I don't think it's feasible to use FMT, as I said, for chronic and very frequent disease. So the field, and I think also that most of the people that are involved in FMT realize that now. The field is now moving from this complex type of microbiome-based treatment to a more controlled one. The first step is to use one bacteria, and this is what we are doing with Fecalibacterium prosnitzii for IBD and other indication. But of course, it makes a lot of sense to try to combine either a limited or even an extensive number of bacteria. But the most important aspect will be that we'll be able to control what we are doing and what we are giving to the patient, and also the possibility, to scale up the production to treat even a very high number of patients.
And Harry, you've done amazing work, as Dan has already alluded to, on Fecalibacterium prosnitzii. Can you tell us the kind of evidence that led you towards working on that bacterium and some of its features, why you think that could be a good therapeutic intervention? And if I can double up on the question, do you see that going down a medical route, developing a drug based on Fecalibacterium prosnitzii, or a drug which is Fecalibacterium prosnitzii? I know that's kind of a double question there.
So, the story of this bacteria was really, again, driven by the data. We started by just analyzing without any a priori the microbiome of patients with IBD, particularly in a postoperative recurrence setting. We saw that patients with Crohn's disease with the lowest amount of this bacteria had a higher chance to relapse. So this was the first element. Then we confirmed actually in other cohorts that that patients with IBD and particularly Crohn's disease had a lower amount of this bacteria. And in other settings, that the lower was the amount of this bacteria, the highest the chance of relapse or activity has the patient. So this was the first, I would say, layer of interest. The second layer of interest was that when we had more data on the normal microbiome, we realized that this bacteria was very specific in the human gut microbiome, because first it was present in the core microbiome, meaning that in healthy subjects you find it in everyone, and this is not a so common feature. There is maybe 10, 15 bacteria like that. And on top of this prevalence, very high prevalence, the amount of this bacteria in the normal microbiota is very high. It's 5, sometimes 10% of the whole fecal colonic microbiome is Fecalibacterium prausnitzii. So when you combine the fact that this bacteria decrease in IBD, that its level is actually predictive of the occurrence of a flare, that it's highly prevalent in healthy subjects, and his abundance is actually huge in the normal microbiome, it's a unique bacteria, I think. And another layer of evidence regarding its interest arrived very recently, thanks to a unique cohort of patients named GEM. So this is a prospective study of subjects who are at risk to develop IBD. And in this study, which was performed mostly in Canada, they showed that many years before the diagnosis of Crohn's disease and even before the onset of inflammation, the alteration of the gut microbiome were already seen. And among this alteration, one of the bacteria, again, was Fecalibacterium prausnitzii. So, yeah, there is all this evidence. Now, the idea is to try to use this bacteria as a drug. So we are really trying to make a drug from this bacteria. The first step is to use it alone. When I say alone, I mean alone in terms of bacteria, because particularly for IBD, I think that the role of the microbiome as a drug should be combined with other approaches targeting the host, because IBD is not a purely microbiome-driven disease. Obviously, the host part has a major importance. And our idea, and actually we already tested this hypothesis in FMT trials, is really to combine treatment targeting the host and treatment targeting the microbiome, and in this case, Fecalibacterium prausnitzii.
And do you think, just as one quick follow-up, and then I let Dan in for a question, do you think that we need to demonstrate almost like a reverse Cox postulates for something like Fecalibacterium prausnitzii too, before we will get general acceptance of scientists, clinicians, and so on? Or do you think with the microbiome, it's always going to be a little bit more fuzzy and complex than Cox postulates?
I think with the microbiome, it's really complex. But if we have a randomized control trial showing that when you give the bacteria compared to a placebo or a control group, you do better than without the bacteria, I think it will be enough. And a very important aspect, and I have very frequently this question, is the engraftment. So when you do FMT, obviously you cannot do it, you know, every day. You have to do it once every 1, 2 months, 3 months. And in the meantime, I mean, between two FMTs, obviously you need that some bacteria from the donor stay in the recipient. And this actually has been demonstrated by very nice meta-analysis done by, for example, Nicola Segata. If there is no engraftment with FMT, you do not have therapeutic effect. But when you are thinking about LBP, and I think this is one of the major advantages of LBP, you can give a pill every day. So even if you don't have this engraftment, and actually I just don't have the answer yet because we don't have the result of the first study we conducted in Crohn's disease yet. But even if there is no engraftment, if you can give the bacteria every day, I think this is okay. And actually you use the bacteria to deliver the active molecules that are either on the bacteria or produced by the bacteria. And it might be enough. At least this is what we see in mice, because in mice, we gavage the bacteria directly in the stomach. And obviously, this is a not friendly environment for these bacteria. And clearly, we do not see engraftment of the bacteria in mice. And despite that, we have a very nice therapeutic effect.
And just related to that, I understand Professor Sokol, that Prosnitsky is specific to inflammatory bowel disease, that depletion of it or experimental restoration of it doesn't have the kind of benefit in patients who just have diarrhea that may not be from inflammatory bowel disease. So that seems to be like that's relevant to the Cox postulate question, but also you're dealing with patients that have either inflammatory bowel diseases or just may have a lot of diarrhea from irritable bowel syndrome. So the
thing is, I mean, we don't know, to be honest, we don't know, because this bacteria, Faecalibacterium prosnitzii, is very sensitive to the environment. And actually, we see a decrease of this bacteria in many different settings. So the decrease of Faecalibacterium prosnitzii is not specific to IBD. It's seen in patients with irritable bowel syndrome and diarrhea, for example. And it's very likely that this bacteria may have multiple effects. For example, it has been shown that the level of this bacteria is predictive of the response to immune checkpoint inhibitors. So we are in the cancer field here. And actually, we have data showing that when you give Faecalibacterium prosnitzii in mice treated for a cancer with immune checkpoint inhibitor, actually you boost the response to the treatment. So it seems that this bacteria may have multiple applications in the therapeutic field.
I did want to turn to another area that you're very involved in, and you've got one of the very prestigious ERC grants to study, and that's the role of the microbiota in tryptophan metabolism. Can you explain the relevance there and why you're interested in the issue?
Yeah, so again, I was really driven by data and results. I did not wake up thinking, oh, I'm going to work on tryptophan. Basically, the story started almost 10 years ago. I was working on a gene called CARB9, which is an IBD susceptibility gene. And we realized that mice lacking CARB9, so CARB9 knockout mice, were more susceptible to intestinal inflammation. And then we realized that the phenotype was driven by the microbiome, because when we transferred the microbiome from these mice into wild-type germ-free mice, we transferred also the phenotype, the susceptibility to colitis. But what was very surprising is that on top of transferring the susceptibility to colitis, we transferred an immune defect. We transferred a defect in interleukin-22 production. And interleukin-22 is a crucial cytokine for intestinal homeostasis. And so we were very puzzled by this result, and we realized that this was related to an alteration in tryptophan metabolism in the microbiome, because some member of the microbiome are able to use tryptophan to produce a very, very large family of molecules called indol. And these indols are able to activate a receptor called aryl hydrocarbon receptor, AHR. And the activation of this receptor, notably on lymphoid cells, leads to the production of interleukin-22. So in these mice, the microbiome was altered in terms of function, lower production of indol, lower activation of AHR, lower production of interleukin-22, and higher susceptibility to colitis. So this was really the entry point. And then we realized that not only the microbiome part was relevant, but the host, the tryptophan metabolism on the host part was also very interesting. There is two main pathways on the host side, the serotonin pathway, which of course leads to the production of serotonin that have many important roles for physiology, and the IDO pathway that leads to kynurenine and many other molecules. And basically what we realized is that the microbiome basically control all this metabolism. It's of course controlling the microbiome part because it's the main actor, but on top of that, the microbiome modulates the production of serotonin in the gut and all the serotonin pathway, and also some aspect of the IDO pathway, of the kynurenine pathway. And in the last, 5 to 8 years, we realized that this tryptophan metabolism in the microbiome and in the host is altered in IBD, but also in alcoholic liver disease, in celiac disease, in rheumatoid arthritis, and in many others. So clearly, it seems that tryptophan metabolism in the microbiome is one of its major functions, a little bit like, you know, production of short-chain fatty acid or metabolism of bile acids.
Yes, you've written a great review article on those three particular metabolic pathways. I wonder, Professor Salko, are you guys monitoring like the gut pancreas axis with regard to like tryptophan? Like, are you concerned that the metabolites from the gut microbiome might aggravate pancreatitis, or the tryptophan coming from the pancreas might?
So we did not start to do that. Okay. We worked on metabolic syndrome, on different types of liver disease also, but not yet on pancreatitis. But yeah, why not?
And Harry, I said I wasn't going to go back to fecal bacterial presidency, but I can't resist. It's such a fascinating topic. I mean, we've worked with it here, and it's not an easy bug to grow. And are you doing any of the kind of technological work that might be necessary to turn it into, let's call it a probiotic or an LBP, a like biotherapeutic, in terms of growing it to very high volumes, drying it, getting it stable at room temperature, any of those kind of things, any of those technological barriers laid on your mind?
So when I started to work on these bacteria for my PhD, I struggled a lot, despite I was working with experts in anaerobic bacteria, and I almost changed off topic, actually, because I was not able to grow it properly. Then we find different ways to do it, at least in the lab. But to move from the lab scale to the industrial scale, it's a completely different story. So we worked with some experts, notably Patrick Gervais, for this topic. And then when we founded a startup, which is named Excelium, to really transfer these bacteria to a drug and to patients, it took us 3 more years to set up the industrial process to grow these bacteria in very large volume, be able to, you know, to freeze dry it and so on. But now it is working. It was, again, a huge bottleneck, but it is working.
And so now you can potentially, well, you're already doing it, I think, administer prescribed doses of the bacterium in a very prescribed manner. And I assume, again, is the interest eventually, and maybe you don't need to go here, to identify the actual molecules that it produces that are having, because a whole bacterium is a type of a polypharmacy, I guess. You don't know which parts are doing what.
Yeah, I fully agree. Of course, we are working on identifying the active molecules since the beginning. Of course, there is butyrate that is produced by the bacteria, obviously, but we do not think most of the effect comes to that. We identified several other molecules that are produced by the bacteria and act notably on the epithelial cells by blocking different pro-inflammatory pathways. But today we think that a large part, maybe the most part of the effect, is related to molecules that are not yet identified, unfortunately, on the bacterial wall, and that act on antigen-presenting cells to drive the immune response toward a regulatory phenotype, high production of IL-10, very low production of pro-inflammatory cytokines such as TNF or IL-12. And yeah, for the moment, here we are. We have different candidates, but it's not yet identified. And I think the fact that this bacteria, as you said, and like many other bacteria, is a polypharmacy, it's also an advantage because we are combining different mechanisms of action and different targets.
Could I ask you not to be a doctor for a moment, but to be a philosopher? Why do you think the human body or animal bodies evolved to require these inputs from these commensal microbes? Why not just do it for ourselves? Why do we depend on these microbes for so many functions, it appears at least?
I think it's really, an evolution story. It's we started to coexist with these bacteria since years and years and millions of years. And I don't have a precise answer, but my understanding is that this is the synergy, the symbiosis between the microbes and our cells. And of course, this took a lot of time. And that's why now we are so well adapted to our microbes and conversely. And this is also probably why now that we changed our way of life in the last, 50 years, which is a very very short time compared to the million years of evolution in the past, there is a problem because our microbiome and the relation between environment, microbiome, and our human cells is altered. And we know now, of course, that this leads to many diseases of our time.
Can I ask you just one last question to look into the future? For patients with Crohn's disease, how optimistic are you that, let's say, in 10 years, we'll have some new or more effective therapies?
So I'm optimistic, but we have to change the mindset. And this is difficult because in the drug development field, people just follow the rules and follow what has been done in the past. And when you are thinking of the microbiome, you know, the microbiome is not a brutal immunosuppressant, obviously. So you cannot develop a microbiome-based drug the same way you develop an anti-TNF. And this is very difficult because you have to change the mind of people doing the clinical research, of pharma industry, of investors, of everyone. It takes time, but I think we are almost there. So I'm quite confident that in the last 5 to 10 years, we'll have microbiome-based drugs that will be used in combination with drugs targeting directly the host.
Well, let's finish up, I think, on that very, very positive note. And thank you again, Ari, for joining us. We really do appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.